This is not your grandma's Bible study.
Hi, and welcome to Not Your Grandma's Bible Study. I'm Joe.
And I'm Zach.
And we're not your grandma.
I am not your grandma.
I could be.
Maybe.
I'm old enough to, I'm just kidding. I'm definitely not old enough to be your grandma. I could maybe be the grandmother of an infant.
Yeah.
35.
Probably.
Maybe like a 7-year-old. This is not an important conversation. So today we're going to talk about Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20. That is the Gerasene demoniac. And it's an interesting story. We're going to take a bit of a post-colonial empire critical perspective on it. So we're not going to read it like, you know, identify with the demon possessed and Jesus will save you kind of thing. We're going to think about how this might be read as maybe an imperial satire, as our guiding discourse conversation person, Hans Leander, in his book Discourses of Empire, The Gospel of Mark from a Post-Colonial Perspective, the chapter he writes on this passage, he does two, one that he reads it as, or he kind of rehashes how it was read during colonial times, so how white colonists read this story and used it to justify their conquest of indigenous peoples in different lands. And then he does a second chapter on it that he actually entitles Imperial Satire, where he reads it as part of an anti-imperial discourse that Mark is engaged with. So the first reading he does of it, or he doesn't actually read it that way, he just explains how it has been read, is as a text that supports colonizing empire, and the second one is one that resists colonizing empire. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about the one where it's resisting. Today, maybe someday we'll come back and talk about some of the craptastic ways the Bible gets used to do all kinds of craptastic things. By craptastic people.
Yeah.
So, I'm going to quickly move my keys out of my pocket so I don't...
Do it.
Jangle them.
This is live.
this is live, people.
This is live.
We're not even going to edit that out.
It's actually recorded, but...
It's recorded live? We're living, people? Yeah. So, a couple of things you might want to know about Mark before we go on is the dating. Like, that's one of the important things. Gospel of Mark, most scholars assume, was written probably between, you know, either right before the destruction of the temple in 70 or shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who don't know, from 66 to 70, Jewish folk, Israelites, people living in Judea, decided that they were real fed up with Roman oppressive rule. And decided to fight back. A lot of it had to do with, oppressive taxes. Rome is siphoning resources away from peasant people. All this. So Rome is like, they kind of don't take them seriously at first. And, you know, these scrappy rebels really, they put up a fight. They give Rome a run for its money.
Yeah.
But in raising the city of Jerusalem, Rome also took out the temple. And that the city was obviously just the target of Rome. I don't think that they quite fully understood how central the temple was to Jewish people at the time. They knew that, you know, they had cultic rituals that happened there, but all the evidence shows that even diaspora Jews, so Jews living outside of the land of Israel at the time, their practices in the synagogue and such were really orienting them towards the temple. They were sending money to the temple. Their texts, the Hebrew Bible, if you read it, it's temple everywhere. Not a drop to drink.
That's exactly how it is.
Yeah. So the temple's like of utmost importance. And so the city itself being raised is, of course, Rome's priority. That's how you...
Hello.
Hello, chiming in, Lord. Jesus is coming down saying, excuse me.
Hold on, correction.
hold my shroud. I don't know. This is already off the rails.
It's great.
Just a couple minutes in, great.
It's great.
So anyway, they come in. It's a really bloody battle. Josephus is a Jewish historian writing at the time. He's admittedly, you know, he's taken Rome's side by this point.
Right.
His story of survival is he and like 26 others or something like that were held captive. So they made a suicide pact.
Right.
They drew lots to off themselves one by one so that somebody could witness, and he just happened to be the last one, and all of a sudden it was revealed to him that it wasn't required that he commit suicide. Conveniently enough for Josephus, but Vespasian, the emperor at the time, Josephus's benefactor, so it's, you've got to read Josephus with a grain of salt, but I mean, he doesn't spare. You can even read when he's reading about the destruction of his homeland, like you can feel the emotion and the devastation that occurred, even with somebody who viewed it as righteous and just and God's judgment on Israel for disobedience or what have you. Even somebody who believes that and has now decided that God is with Rome still is heartbroken about the destruction of the temple. So the temple ended up being really, the destruction of the temple, I think, is super pivotal. It's pivotal in the history of Judaism. The temple is destroyed twice, but this one in particular, you know, it's not rebuilt, and there's really no plans to rebuild it kind of thing. And so you get the development of the rabbis. So the text becomes really important, more so than the cultic ritual stuff, and so it really changes what Judaism is, and it also provides some fertile ground for, in my opinion, fertile ground for the growth of Christianity. Christianity was, you know, Jesus followers were already kind of resisting cultic practices in some ways, not completely. And by cultic practices, I don't mean like a cult.
Yeah,
I don't mean like
a cult.
I just mean like ritual behaviors occurring in a sacred space. And so that kind of, those cultic practices, the Eucharist in a church is a cultic practice for Christians.
Right.
So it's not a slur or a negative word if you're not familiar with that kind of language. So, the destruction's huge. And Mark is being written at the very least during the war. Possibly right after. Some of the language that he uses when he talks about, you know, the destruction of city in Mark 13, I think, in his little mini apocalypse, it's hard to tell if he's sort of, you know, if he can see the writing on the wall and just knows the end is near with Jerusalem, or if it has already happened. But in any event, it's being written during a really delicate time. Some have argued that it was written in Rome. There's some language that suggests that in the text. But, you know, there are others who believe that maybe it was written in Galilee. But I think either way, the people who are reading Mark after the destruction are people who have some sense of what happened in that. Rome was really big on making sure that people understood their place. The Judaic Capta coins are coins that were minted right after that, you know, personify Judea, so the land of Israel, as a woman in submissive positions with Roman overlords, you know, a Roman soldier with, I think, a sword in some. Sometimes there's a palm tree to represent the land. So there's, it's, I mean, Rome really went to a lot of effort to humiliate Israel and Judea after this war, to remind them that they're victors. And so, you know, I think it's Monty Python and maybe The Life of Brian, I can't remember, or The Holy Grail, one of the two, but the, you know, the group of men who are going to come together and revolt against Rome.
Oh, yeah, that's Life of Brian.
What has Rome ever done for us? And they're like, nothing. And then somebody's like, roads.
Roads.
Medicine.
Aqueducts.
Yeah. So this long list of all the things. And he's like, okay, well, besides roads and education and aqueducts and medicine and lists like seven things, what has Rome ever done for us? I'm like, nothing. that's a revolt kind of thing. So, you know, there's maybe people who read this in the first century who saw benefits to Rome. And then there may have been some who had a family member that died during the siege on Jerusalem mm-hmm. or something along those lines, or, you know, shared in that collective trauma. So in the midst of all of this violence happening from Rome and in its aftermath, Mark is telling these stories. And granted, the stories probably circulated before, but some of the specificity of the military language within this is really interesting. Mm-hmm, so Hans Leander notes that, you know, it's becoming more of a scholarly consensus that this is an anti-Roman story. There are still some people who don't want to put it that way, but he notes that as early as 1830, there are people who are recognizing anti-Roman aspects of this particular passage, even though they're not necessarily being critical of empire per se. Mm. They're reading it that way, but they're still, it's still the 1830s and they're in colonizing projects. And
yeah, it's pretty early to start making that kind of a critique.
Yeah, and so they recognize that there's some anti-Roman language in it, but they don't necessarily read it as critical of empire. So the big thing to think about here is the demons. So for those who aren't familiar with the story, Jesus has just crossed the Sea of Galilee. He's calmed this raging storm that scares his disciples. He gets off of the boat, and immediately upon getting out of the boat, a man from the tombs comes with an unclean spirit, and that's the word that Mark uses, denoting some sort of possession experience that this guy's living in. So the guy lived among the tombs. He was unable to be bound. People tried binding him, but he would just break the chains. He broke shackles to pieces, and nobody had the strength to subdue him. Kind of makes me think of, have you seen the movie Split? Hmm. With James McAvoy?
Sure.
He's really talented, but anyway, one of his personalities is like super strong. Anyway, it says, night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, this man was always crying and cutting himself with stones. So when he sees Jesus, he runs to Jesus, falls before him, and cries out with a loud voice, saying, "What have you done? What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For Jesus was saying to the man, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" And the man replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send him out of the country. So Jesus instead sends him into a herd of swine feeding on the hillside. The demons go into the pigs. The pigs rush down a steep bank into the sea, and they're drowned in the water. And then the city hears about it, and the city folk were very upset and asked Jesus to leave. So it's an interesting story and
nice
odd
story.
Responses, but the name of the demon being Legion is sort of your first clue here that we've got some anti-Roman propaganda here. So feel free to chime in any time.
Sure.
I'm not lecturing you.
No.
You know a lot of this as well.
It's a refresher for me.
So the use of Legion, some biblical scholars have a hard time recognizing that a legion was a particular unit of the Roman military. So my quick refresher on Roman military structure is you have the Roman centuries. So you have groups of up to 100. Typically, I think they sat at about 80. And then a legion was 10 centuries or maybe 12 centuries. So it's a really large military force, and in
5,000.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm looking it up online right
now. Thank you. I mean, I literally just wrote a dissertation chapter around the Methian version of this story. Wow. I don't remember what I wrote. It was really good though. I can't wait to go back and read it and learn from myself. revisit my own knowledge. So the word, legion, in our language, in, you know, American English, presumably maybe in British English, I don't know. But we use legion to talk about, like, a big number of things. And so we kind of, you know, assume that what we see it in the Sanjay text that, you know, the early Christian audience or whatever would have understood it to mean for we are many as well. But the fact that Mark adds that qualifier indicates that he's giving it a new usage. So the word is legion, I think, something like that's probably pronounced, but we'll just say legion for good measure. But it's a loan word, and it literally only denotes, in all of the textual evidence from the time, only denotes Roman troops.
Yeah.
So if the author of Mark were wanting to just reference a big number of military or whatever, mm-hmm. or a big number, he has all kinds of words at his disposal to do that. He has all kinds of words to talk about troops in general, but legion is very specific to a certain level or certain grouping of Roman soldiers. It's a Latinism, so it's a loan word. And loan words don't happen too much in the gospel, so it's really being pulled over directly.
Mm-hmm.
The 10th for Tensus Legion was the legion that was stationed closest to Jerusalem. At this time, the 10th for Tensus Legion is the legion, or one of two legions maybe, responsible for the destruction of Jerusalem.
Interesting.
And their mascot, or their emblem, was a boar or a pig.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. You're starting to see what's happening here.
Connect the dots.
Connecting the dots. So, you know, Hans Leander, he's arguing that, him and several others are arguing that, you know, legion's not, it's not a common metaphor at the time.
Right.
It's, you know, he tells us, you know, everyday language is made up of metaphorical words and phrases that pass unnoticed as dead metaphors for us. So for us, you know, the branch of an organization is a dead metaphor. We don't see the tree in our mind. Kidney beans, we don't think about the fact that they're called that because they're shaped like kidneys.
Right.
It's a dead metaphor for us. But since Mark's curious use of this word was in all likelihood previously unheard of, it wouldn't have passed unnoticed like that for this initial audience, and it shouldn't for us now that we know. There's a guy, his name's Joshua Garraway. He gives a similar analogy to how this story, you know, if this story had first appeared in U.S.-occupied Iraq here recently, he says that, you know, it might have been at, you know, when the demon was asked for his name, the demoniac would then answer, you know, in Arabic, the Ismi Marines, Li Anana Kithurun. I don't speak Arabic, so if I'm wrong on all that, I am sincerely sorry. But that would translate as, my name is Marines, for we are many. Now, granted, it's a weak analogy, I mean, but that sort of obvious double entendre, you know, saying Marines, which is the military presence, a particular military presence, mm-hmm. not just I am soldier, for we are many.
Right.
But I am Marines, a particular type, and then qualifying it and changing its meaning to because we are many. Not only references the multitude of demons, but the size of these troops.
Right.
So Legion is a really important component of the story to recognize that you've got some military stuff going on here. Now, there's other military language in the passage that Leander points out. So once you have that, the other stuff doesn't necessarily in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these individual words are used in other contexts besides military stuff, but there's some density to their use in this particular story paired with legion sort of allude to these bigger military practices. So he writes that the imagery of the Markan episode adds further weight to the double reference inherent in legion. As pointed out, by another scholar, Duncan Derrett. The text is imbued with military vocabulary. Once the name Legion has been revealed, several other military allusions are displayed. So at 5:10, the Legion, or the demons, say he begged Jesus earnestly not to send them out of the country. So send is apostille, and that means dispatch. And so for Roman, or for military context, that's a term used for an officer sending out troops. Verse 11, now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. Agale, the word used, that means, that's translated as herd, was also a local term for a band of military trainees.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 13, so he gave them permission and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. So the end, he gave them permission piece. So epitrepsin, the word for permission or permitted, could denote an issuing of a military command. And then in later in 5:13, the pigs, they rushed down the steep bank into the sea. The word hormason, rushed, is the word used for when troops rush into battle. So lots of military language going on here. Any observations about those military components that you want to add or?
The only thing that came up for me in kind of revisiting that as you were saying it is thinking about that's a thing that happens in Hebrew too. Of course, now I'm going to blank on some examples, but that's how language works though. I mean, you have common everyday uses for things, but military, I think what it does is it shows that military was a part of everyday, and so that you have maybe what we'll call civilian usage and we'll have military usage, but because the two are so close together that people would obviously understand potentially more than one. They hear both definitions at the same time. And for hearers of Mark, it's not a surprise that they would quickly pick up on the fact that, you know, they live under occupation. They are in the middle of a battle, so it's not like military life is far from them. War is really at their doorstep. Yeah. So they would hear that and immediately make that connection.
Yeah, and then Mark's use of Legion explicitly signals to the hearers of this story the rest of this language that you hear that, you know, might be used in everyday, you know, speech. I'm meaning it in its military forms.
Mm-hmm.
So Legion, this, all these military words, the fact that the pig is the emblem for the Legion, it's all really interesting. And so these colonizing aspects of Rome in the area, you know, this story is sort of telling you, makes people behave in certain ways. Demon possession in the ancient world was, I mean, demons were basically a really convenient way to explain anything you didn't like.
Right.
there's not consistent symptomatology. I mean, this man in particular seems to be, I mean, he's involved in a lot of self-harm. He's not practicing any kind of restraint against himself or against others. He just cannot be calmed down. He's living in the tombs, so he's ostracizing himself. And the living in the tombs, people really want to play up the fact that the tombs for Jewish folk would have been, you know, unclean territory, which is, I mean, not totally wrong. But I think the assumption then is it's, and I've seen this, especially in the stuff that I was reading for the Matthean version where they live in the tombs as well, is that then that becomes like they're unclean, therefore they're unworthy, they're gross, it becomes a moral judgment. And just to be really clear, like cleanliness and purity laws in Judaism, then as today, have literally nothing to do with morality. There are moral and immoral things that can cause purity or impurity.
Sure, sure.
But to be impure is to be human.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with any sort of reflection of the character of the person who's unclean. I mean, women who have babies are unclean for X amount of days.
Mm-hmm,
and so you know, men who have have sex are unclean. And because there are no rules on high priests not being able to be married, I mean, the holiest men among Israel at some point are going to be unclean. So it's not a moral, it's not a moral judgment. So there too much, I think, is made of that. I think a lot of it has to do that he's living in a place of death. He's living among the dead, as opposed to with the living. He's ostracized, as the tombs would have been outside of town. So this all sort of reflects how Rome's power, violent power, is creating like a living death in people in Rome. So it's, I mean, it's a really powerful story. I mean, we think of it as, you know, like this crazy guy, and then he's not crazy later. But I think one of the things that's interesting, and I bring this out in stuff that I've written, is, you know, as somebody living among the tombs, as somebody who's this ostracized from community, you're talking about somebody who, in terms of social ranking in the ancient world, would be in the expendable class. I mean, the lowest of the low, probably having to rely on begging to survive. And so you have this person possessed by legion, aka being made crazy by colonizing Rome, refusing the help of the one who can help him. I mean, he immediately goes up to Jesus to confront him. What do you have to do with me? What? Why are you here? Why are you in my business? Kind of thing. And I think that's a reflection of what Rome does. I mean, Rome siphons resources away from the people who need it the most. And so this is sort of an embodiment of that. Like, Rome as a possessing force, Rome being really, like, unquestionably identified as demonic in this passage, hurting the lowest of the low in the community. And I mean, I think it's got some really powerful stuff going on. One of the things also, Stephen Moore is, he's a guy who's done some work on Empire as well. He's done some post-human things and post-deconstructualist things. Some of his stuff is, what's the word that Dr. Carter, my advisor, used to talk, to describe? He's at his ephemeral best in the piece that I had to summarize the other day. So he can be really heady and all over the place. But he has a little book called Empire and Apocalypse, and he talks about this passage in Mark. And he notes that the word Gerasa, so the name of the city that this man is in, it has a Hebrew root. Would it be Goresh or Geres? I can't remember which side the dot goes on.
It'd be Geres.
Geres. Makes sense, Gerasa.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Geres. So the Hebrew word Geres means to banish, to drive out, or to cast out. So he argues that, you know, the setting itself is showing that the land is in need of exorcism, and what needs to be exorcised out of the land? The Roman military. In this case, so so there's some really interesting anti-Roman things going on here, and of course, you know, the pigs drown themselves in the sea once they're possessed, and then we get the weird little bit where the townspeople are really unhappy that Jesus has done this, and you know, I think I've heard some sermons, you know, about like being unhappy for others' blessings, and, you know, don't be the townspeople.
With this story?
Kind of thing. I mean, this is one part and part. I mean, some of it, I think, would probably be more rooted in, like, the prodigal son story.
Sure, sure.
But this kind of comes to mind, too, in that train of thought of, you know, these outsiders who see Jesus do something good in the life of an individual and then resenting that goodness. But I don't think that's what's going on here. So what are your thoughts on this resistance by the town folk?
I think a lot of it, like, thinking of if legion is representative of the Romans, and then the act of removing Rome from the area causes catastrophic economic damage to the people. And so That's always what I've kind of thought about it. The fact that like their whole livelihood was just wiped out by Legion. And so obviously they're going to look at Jesus and be like, you just destroyed any means we had to stay alive. And without necessarily understanding, but that's, I think like that's a really interesting and important way of understanding how colonialism works, mm-hmm. that the lower class, the people who are being oppressed and occupied and colonized are stuck in this weird fraught relationship of trying to survive but also trying to resist. And mm-hmm. so here Jesus comes as a liberator in a sense, and he's not only getting the demon out of this man, he's, you know, in effect removing Rome from the area, but as a result it destroys the pigs that are on the hillside. And so
I mean, that's what colonialism does. You're right. It's it puts people in a position to become dependent on the colonizer in a way where resistance to the colonizer becomes difficult, because what has Rome ever done for us? Roads. Well, if we get rid of Rome, then what do we do with all these roads? Or what do we, you know, they've brought us medicine
mm-hmm.
that has changed our lives. How do we get rid of that kind of thing? So one of the other things that I think is going on here is some of it is, you know, you've destroyed your artist's survival with the pigs, but even those who didn't rely on the pigs for their economic well-being, you know, there's multiple ways of negotiating your colonizing powers. And so I think that there are some who not necessarily are in bed with Rome, but who... for whom the status quo is survival.
Mm-hmm.
And to mess with that status quo, even for a greater good, is on the individual level frightening and terrifying. And I mean, I think we see that today, even mm-hmm. in the United States context, that there are things, there are opinions that I have that I would love to share a little bit more openly. But, you know, within particular contexts that I'm a part of, it's the status quo of me just keeping my mouth shut
mm-hmm.
Is the safer option for me,
right?
Even if in the larger scale of things, it's the weaker option, if you will,
right.
The more cowardly option.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I don't think I'm alone in kind of, you know,
no,
you know, in that sort of experience. But one of the other things that's I find happening here, I think, is it's a little bit more explicit in Matthew, because Matthew's Jesus has some teaching on this explicitly, and I don't think he does in Mark, but I could be wrong. So ancient understandings, again, of demons was that they were kind of around every corner.
Sure.
So in Matthew, Jesus talks about how, you know, you cast a demon out, and if you don't keep the house clean, it's going to come back with seven of its buddies, and things are going to be worse. So as part of what's going on here, not so much about the economic piece, but like, we knew where the demons were.
Yeah.
And you just let it free. And now we don't know who's, you know, it was contained. It was, we knew where it was. We knew what it could do.
Mm-hmm.
But we were safe from the demon. We mm-hmm. were safe from Rome. It was just hurting this one person, not everybody. And now it's out. And so, you know, this idea of, I mean, it's a satire, it's sort of revenge fantasy, but I mean, is this Mark's way of sort of acknowledging that, like, if we did this, if we really did cast Rome out, there are repercussions. And some people are afraid of those repercussions mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I think this story is really interesting, and there's so much that could be talked about with it.
Yeah.
But just wanted to highlight today some of the anti-Roman language that's going on there and some of the ambiguity around that. And this story, you know, it does go back to the demon-possessed man. It cuts back to him after, you know, Jesus is trying to leave. When Jesus was getting to the boat, the man begged Jesus, "Can I please come with you?" And Jesus is like, "Nope." He said, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And the man went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So you still have people who are like, "Whoa, this is crazy." Like, so that you do have positive response to this man as well. But I think it's all, I just think it's interesting that Jesus is like, no, no, bro. But he's commissioned, I mean, in some ways. I mean, he's commissioned as the disciples are, as an apostle to these people in the Decapolis for mm-hmm. what's been done for him. So just a lot. We could talk forever about this, but we won't, because we're trying to get better about Jill shutting up.
No, it's not about Jill shutting up.
It is a little bit about Jill shutting up. I could talk for hours and hours and hours about all of this stuff. I think it's fascinating. But, yeah, so that's Gerasene Demoniac. Final thoughts that you have?
I think it's just a really important, too, just going through this, that growing up for me, I definitely had what I call now depoliticized readings of mm-hmm. the New Testament. And so I think these little stories offer really, really important insights into the ways in which people on the ground, so to speak, back then probably did and could have engaged with their time mm-hmm. rather than, because I think so often I hear people say, well, this story doesn't make sense. Like, okay, it's weird. You know, yeah, there's this guy and he's got a bunch of demons and then these pigs die in the water and everyone's upset at him. And then some weird, yeah, moralistic, mm-hmm. spiritualized meaning comes out of it and everyone's kind of scratching their heads going, okay, I'll be grateful for when things go well for someone else, versus you come at it from going, here's the historical context behind it, here's what yeah. was happening at the same time, and here are these really clear signs that actually point to being anti-Roman, and then that starts helping you understand a different set of morals and ethics and politics and the ways in which that the Bible functions politically, big P, ethically, big E, in the ways in which we use these texts to understand our world today.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good summary. Like,
and wrap.
And that's a wrap. So you can listen to us now we're on SoundCloud. We are on Apple Podcasts. We are on the Stitcher app. And we are on Spotify.
We're everywhere.
So I have spent way too much time trying to link our feed to those separate. So, yeah, that's where you can listen to us. Like, I ain't fighting with any other
and
podcast
SoundCloud. We're on SoundCloud.
Provider.
Hosted on SoundCloud.
Hosted on SoundCloud.
We're five places. You
yeah.
can find us five places.
Four.
Sorry.
SoundCloud. Yeah, SoundCloud yeah. is one of them. So, but I ain't messing with iHeartRadio. I ain't messing with Pandora, apparently, is starting to do podcasts. So
no. Sorry.
On Apple Podcasts, especially, if you could rate us and review us, helps give us some more visibility. Share with your friends. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We have a Facebook page. Have a website. You can look for us there. If you have questions about anything that we've talked about or suggestions for passages you'd like to hear us tackle, there's a metaphor for you, football, foosball. Feel free to email us at notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com. Yeah. And any other things, just rate, review, tell
That's
your
it.
Friends, how great we are.
Please listen to us.
Please listen to us to the end. Amen and Selah. I think that's a good closer. Amen and Selah.
Catch you next time.